feels a little different to sing a creed. Does anybody agree? Or you're used to that? Anybody really good at memory, like at memorizing stuff? No, some of you are great at it. Those of you that have your hand, what do you have any hints? Because I'm really, really bad at memory. Do you have any hints, like anything that helps you? Nope.
Write it down.
Write it down? Okay, that was one that they told me. For Michael, you got one?
I have one, but I can't remember.
Man, that's going to be the only laugh I get the whole sermon. That's the set. My heart kind of just sank. So that everybody can, he had them, but he can't remember them, for those that didn't hear. Honestly, memory, I was raised in a public school until sixth grade, and when I went into sixth grade, my teacher in memory verse gave me an F. It was the first F I ever got. I shouldn't say she gave me an F. I didn't memorize anything, and so I earned an F. And I went home, and I still remember looking at my mom in the face and going, "Mom, when will I ever need to have anything from the Bible memorized? How will that help me in my life?" And see, sometimes it felt like this to memorize. Some of the hints that people gave me, just say it over and over. Say it out loud, so if you can say it with me. Sausage, blubber, pencil, cloud, moon, water, computer, school, network, hammer. Somebody said if you put them on shaped cards, it makes it easier to memorize. Circles are easier to memorize than square cards. Some people said spell them out loud, which was really fun for me because I was dyslexic. So it would be like S-A-U-A-G-E, swage. Did not help. If we're honest, some of us, especially those that were raised in a system where it made you memorize, and I'm not anti-memorizing, memorization without application, I'm totally against. But just straight memorization, it's good. It's good to have a shorthand. But sometimes we need to dig in and ask, what does this mean? When we're talking about a creed, this was the opening line to the creed. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. See, what happened, to give a little bit of history, if you know the context, about 33, Jesus was crucified, died, and buried. At that point, they when he resurrected, they put out a manhunt on anybody that claimed to be a Christian. You yourself would be killed if you were part of the church. So the church went underground, and they kept it quiet. This served many purposes, but the church, by 326, is that right, Brian, 326? 318? By 318, sorry, I know somebody is going to ask me about that later. By 318, the church finally was more than 51% of the community. And for the first time ever, they had a gathering where they said, hey, what do we all agree on? See, there's some things that as a church we just have to agree on. What had happened is if I let you all, for a season, ask tough questions and answer tough questions, you'd come up with great answers. But if you were asking the same questions as this group over here was asking, you all would come up with some great answers too, but I could almost guarantee your answers would be different from your answers. So what the council did is they got together, this was the Council of Nicaea, they got together and they said, what are the essential things that Christians believe? How do we shape it into a statement so we know, hey, this is what the Bible really teaches, a summary statement of our faith. And so over the next couple weeks, we're going to dig into that. Today, we're just going to hit this, and then we're going to look at his story, Jesus' story. What were Jesus' life turns? What were the things that people have captured for the last 2,000 plus years? So it'll be really, really fun, I promise. Here's how it started. It said, I credo. This is where we get creed from. Creed, I believe. I credo in God. The opening line to this didn't shock anybody. In 318, 326, when they gathered together, everybody believed in God. I'd actually go so far as to say 2,000 years later, it's not all that different. Everybody believes in God. Everybody believes in some kind of higher power. Everybody believes in something that's bigger than themselves. It's what we do, which God we believe in, that gets really interesting. Right? Some people make gods of their jobs. Some people make gods of the president. Some people make gods of their boss. It was no different back then. But what these 300-plus people did is they pressed into and they opened with, I believe in God, and people would naturally ask the question, what God? Oh, sorry, I can tell you. I had it written down, so I wouldn't forget it. It was Constantine. It was in 325, and there were 318 people in attendance. Uh-oh. Who remembered sausage? Okay. What was next on the list?
Blubber.
Let's see if you were right. What was next?
Pencil.
Next. See what just happened? It goes from sausage, blubber, pencil. Cloud. See, this is what happens next. One person knows what it is, so they say it really loud, and then there's this echo effect. It's kind of fun. Okay. Computer, we got to go quick so people don't cheat. That's cool. Of course, network. Oh. Okay, what just happened? Boop, boop. Uh-oh. No. What just happened is what's called the primacy effect. Just a little psychology here. Whatever you see first is what's going to stick with you. People have known this for millennia. The first thing you see is what sticks with you. This is why when you go for a job interview and it's your first impression, you want to make a good first impression. This is the primacy effect. Whatever you see first sticks with you. This is why, if we're honest, we have some relationships in our life where they made a great first impression. And so even years later, when the relationships become meh, we call back to that first impression, that primacy effect, and we stick in the relationship. Other people, that first impression was just horrible. The first thing they said, just, it was nails on a chalkboard. And even though they had all kinds of other people vouch for them, you still go back and you're like, but Joe's just, when you script things, put what you want people to remember, put what you want people to resonate with out there first. This is what they did. They said, if we've got to define who God is, let's start with the thing that's most important. We believe in God, the Father Almighty. Now, some of the questions that I'm going to ask today are really basic answers, so don't overthink this. What's the one thing that a father has to do? Like, if you don't do this, you're not a father. Bingo! Have children. That's it. The first thing we learn about God is that God is a relational God. God is defined by God's relationship. A father has to have a kid. A father has to have a son or a daughter. If they don't, they're not. And don't confuse this. This isn't like our dads. I'm one, so you know, once you are one, you can criticize. You know, there's some days where dad is just nailing it out of the park and these Bible verses make sense, and you're like, yes, I understand why God is the father. And there's other days where you just blow it. Now, when we're talking about the relationship with God, God the Father Almighty, God the perfect God who loves his Son perfectly, God who provides perfectly for all that he creates, that's the God we're talking about. When they wrote the creed, they said, I believe in God the Father Almighty, because the thing they knew about God is that his essence was relational. See, what the Bible teaches us is that we're made in the image of God, in the Imago Dei. First, God is relational. Then, we talk about what God does. I believe in God, the Father Almighty, maker of heaven and earth. How many of us do just the opposite? If we're honest, we don't define ourselves by our essence. We define ourselves by what we do. I love working with athletes because it's really, really easy to peel that away. Are you defined by how many rebounds you have and how many times you put the ball through the hoop? I'm amazed how many people are. If I put the ball through the hoop more times than I did last time, then I'm a better person. If I put it through less, then I'm less of a being. And it's not just athletes that do it. That's where it becomes easy. How many of us do it? If I made more money last year than I made this year, if I booked more clients than this year. See, what we learn from the Creed is that God first defines himself by who he is, then what he does. What God does flows out of who he is. And to be honest with you, that's a better way to live. To stop and go, hey, who am I? And then work out of that. But I want to dig into this little maker of heaven and earth. Does anybody know what a callback is? Okay, a callback is when you're watching Star Wars 7 and all of a sudden you see the AT fighter laying down in the ground. If you know the backstory, you get a lot more from it. You'll know that there was a battle there. You'll know that there was a storyline. If you ever watch a comedian will tell a joke, then 7, 8, 9 minutes later, he'll say one or two words and you'll laugh because of the joke he told 7, 8 minutes ago. That's a callback. We pay attention to these in books, in movies. When they say maker of heaven and earth, what those 318 men are saying is this is part of a bigger narrative. When you hear the word maker of heaven and earth, think Bible, where should your brain instantly go? Genesis. Specifically, how's that start? In the beginning. Right? Something happened to the ancient people. They heard in the beginning. By the way, who's seen Star Wars? Okay. How many of you saw it at midnight? Okay. Just the two of us. Me and you.
Hey, what if we saw it before midnight?
When'd you see it?
We saw
that 9:30. Then I'm jealous. If you saw it, so what happened, especially those that saw it early, what happened when on the screen it said, a long time ago in a galaxy far, far away? Exactly. Nothing had even happened yet. Those blue letters appeared on the screen and everybody clapped because they were that impressed with today's graphic design that somebody could type those four words. No, they clapped because they knew it was part of a bigger story. At that Council of Nicaea, when they said maker of heaven and earth, somebody goes, in the beginning! And they erupted because they knew it was part of a bigger story. See, here's the bigger story. When we look at Genesis, boom, oh man, spoiler. Oh, wow. Sorry, I'm learning how to use this new app. In the beginning, God created. So when we say maker of heaven and earth, this is what we're calling to. But in Hebrew, there's this intriguing thing that happens. In Hebrew, every single word has, it's either masculine or feminine. It's either singular or plural. It's a lot like Spanish, which, by the way, is the second class that I failed. I thought that if you just add O, this is what I caught, O is masculine, A is feminine. So I just figured if you took any English word and added an O or an A to the end, that worked. It doesn't. But in Hebrew, it's that same way. Each word they taught that your cases have to match. So if Henry, singular, masculine, were to take a drink, the word drink, the verb, would become singular and masculine. They have to match or it's bad grammar. So they teach all these little Hebrew boys and girls this, and then they give them the first words of Torah, where it says, in the beginning, or Genesis, God, Elohim, plural, masculine, created, singular, masculine. And after the kids got over the initial shock of going, whoa, 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 they did that wrong, they were left with this question: how can God be plural and singular? How can God be multiple yet one? And as they read on, it got even worse. They read, and the earth was without form and void, and darkness was over the face of the deep, and the Spirit, pneuma, singular, feminine, of God, Elohim, plural, masculine. How can God be genderless and plural and yet singular? And as they read on, by the third, and the Spirit of God was hovering over the face of the waters, and God, plural, masculine, said, singular, masculine. See, looking at those first three verses, they went, hold on, somehow we've got this God creator, this God spirit, and this God, by the way, when we say things, what do we say? Think really base. It's like, what's a father got to do? When we say things, what do we say? Words. This God that's creator, spirit, and word. That somehow this God is one, but this God is three. This God has a relationship with God's self. See, when they said maker of heaven and earth, they were calling back to all of this. By the way, John, when you read the Gospel of John, anybody remember how it starts? In the beginning. And when the people are reading it, they're going, in the beginning, God created. Whoa! In the beginning was the Word. And as we read through this, we see this relationship between Father and Son, between God the Father who created the world through the Word and redeemed the world through that same Word. We see that God is essentially, and I'm talking that in true essence, the stuff that God's made of is relationship. I told you guys last week that I've been working through trying to figure out how to pray, which is a weird thing for a pastor to say, but what's it really look like to dig in, to not just become rote in prayer, to not just always go to God and go, God, here's my checklist of what I want for Christmas. And I was introduced to this Acts model. The first one is adoration. In case you don't know this, it's adoration, confession, thanksgiving, and asking for stuff, supplication. But I struggled with what's the difference between thanksgiving and adoration. Because, see, I live in a culture where I say thank you when I get something, but I don't focus on the essence. Adoration isn't about the thing, it's about the essence. What's it look like to stop and adore God for who God is? So when we stop and we adore God for who God is, and we realize that God is essentially relational, man, we're tasked with some tough questions. I mean, first, I think in this very natural plane, how are my relationships? Are there relationships that have just become toxic? I mean, that primacy effect, I had a great first run with them, but now all it does is builds up anger and resentment and brokenness. Are there relationships that in this season of life, I just have to go, you know, I need to step away and put some distance there? You see, that's what God does with sin. God goes, sin is toxic, sin is hurting, and I need to just put a distance between me and that. I can't go there. By the way, that's why he sent Jesus, because Jesus dealt with all that sin. so that we can have a relationship with God. And in that relationship with God, we're freed from that sin. See, in that relationship with God, we have the ability to respond, to say that toxic habit that I haven't been able to shake for years, I can step away from it now because of the person and work of Christ. I can go into that more and more, but you know what I'm talking about. See, some of us, when we're looking at this, we go, there's some relationships that are toxic that I just got to break. So when we're talking about relationships, there's other places where that thing happened and it hurt, and I needed that time. And I've got to put that anger and resentment aside. And for years I've said, if they just make the first step, I'll make the second one. What's it look like if you make the first step? What's it look like to reach out and just say, hey, we might not ever be able to be the way that we were, but can we heal those wounds? What's it look like in that relationship? And then, as you evaluate your relationships, what are those relationships where you just need to invest in? You've let them slide. I mean, it could have been busyness. It could have been, the list is real long. But it's just time to return. It's time to come back. It's time to pull out the phone and schedule that date with your spouse and not let anything else creep in. It's time to call that friend and heal that relationship. Make the first step. Why? Because you are created in the image of God, and that's what God does over and over and over. That's why God comes to us in with and under this bread and this wine. See, sometimes we hear it one way, and sometimes hearing it another way just sticks. There was a young couple. They'd gotten married, and they'd grown old together. And they were driving in that same pickup that they'd driven for the last 30 years. It was just the farm pickup, so they never really put miles on it. You know what I'm talking about, the old beat-up farm pickup, the one that has that one seat in the front? The guy's driving, and his wife looks over at him, and she looks at the car that's passing in the other lane, and in that lane coming right towards him is that young couple. You know the one I'm talking about, where now that there are two separate seats, you can't tell because she's sitting that close to him, and he has his arm around her, and she just looks up at her husband, and she says, honey, remember when you used to hold me that close? Remember when you used to draw me that close? I miss that relationship. And it was great because the guy looked forward and he looked at his steering wheel. And he looked at her and he said, hey, babe, is that wheel moved? A little bit annoyed. She said, nope. He said, then neither have I. And how often is that our relationship with God? We're like, God feels so far away. But God's been in the same place that he's always been. And he's longing to draw us back to him, to pull us back into his arm, to remind us of the relationship that he wants with us, the relationship that he has with us, that we can taste his love. See, you can say it in that kind of story, or you can say it the way that Jesus said it.